Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Coming up on this Tuesday edition, trade wars are happening. It's getting pretty intense. We've got some updates about that from the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll preview that. Also, what is it like to be a space tourist? This is actually happening. People are going to space, and not as fun as you might think. We've got some details about that. Also, big trouble for bees, and that's a big trouble for all of us. That and more coming up on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG online here at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to, at kpcgfm. There's plenty of room. We can take as many followers as you care to bring. I think. There's no limit to followers, right?
I don't think so.
How many do you have, Abraham? About 10 million?
On my Twitter?
Yeah.
I'll remain that to be anonymous or undisclosed.
Somewhere between 1 and 10 million.
Yeah. Somewhere between the population of the Earth and 20.
Okay, there you go. Also, if you'd like to email us, you can do that. Comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today. And a lot to talk about on today's program, including the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, which is with your host, Stephen Fleury. I talked a lot more today about some of the trade wars that are heating up. Really good program. Make sure you listen for that. If you didn't catch it live or you can't catch a replay, you can get the archives online at kpcg.fm. And Donald Trump's very active, President Trump, and he had that meeting with Angela Merkel recently. And so the thought is, I guess, that the U.S. is indispensable, but the rest of the world thinks maybe not. So that was talked about on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today.
Yeah, I think we're at an odd transition point in history where after World War II, all the big countries are bankrupt, broken, war-torn, except for the Soviet Union and the United States. But now, after 70-plus years since then, after America has pumped billions of dollars into Germany, rebuilding it, all these countries are now self-sustainable. And so I think America's role politically and economically holding up the nations of the world after a pretty savage war is becoming less viable.
I saw a headline today, too, where they were talking about how there's a lot of focus on how the Dow Jones is so high, but they said we should be focusing on one other fact, and there's $20 trillion of debt in the U.S. I don't have it. I can't pay it back. How about you? You got it?
No, not even close. But it's a good thing, personally, to at least try to avoid debt.
It is.
But obviously, we don't have trillions of dollars to pay it back either.
Right. I mean, we're all part of this big system, and of course, you've got to try to be wise personally, but there is this massive, massive debt. And I don't know, we've just come to kind of accept it, I guess, that, oh, well, we just have all this debt. And I remember when President Trump was campaigning, he talked about loving debt. He loved debt. He could refinance it and work a deal and all of this. But more and more, you look at how well China's doing, Germany and some other nations, and they're banding together now, as is brought out in the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're finding ourselves as the odd man out. That's a bad, bad deal.
Yeah, it is pretty disturbing, too, how we have just come to accept debt like it's just a part of life and actually how it's ideal, because you can buy things for thousands of dollars that you actually don't have, but you want that thing, so you'll get into debt for it. And then we're seeing the same thing take place nationally. We wouldn't really be one of the most reliable partners, especially if one of the people who has given us all that money asks for it back. Then we're not a power on the world stage at all.
It's funny how I've seen some write-ups. They always kind of have these financial write-ups. They're talking about, oh, how much money do you have for retirement? You know, and they have these numbers out there like, well, you need to save up at least $1 million for retirement. And then you look at these other numbers of the personal debt levels, unemployment levels. And I'm thinking, how many people out there are really, you know, putting away millions of dollars or $1 million towards retirement? It can't be very many.
I couldn't imagine a regular person making you know, maybe like a middle class type salary would have $1 million put away anytime soon. Unless they save every penny, which people don't seem to do anymore.
No. And then things do happen too. You have emergencies come up. You need a new roof. You need to go to the dentist. You know, all kinds of things happen. Your kids want stuff. They're always taking from you. Always. Or you're giving to them. I'm not sure which way that goes. It's a combination. But I always find it interesting when I see those headlines saying, you know, you need $1 million. I'm like, really? Who has $1 million saved up? Personally, personal finances in this country aren't great. And then the national finances are horrible. So
yeah, well, not $20 trillion of debt. That's just the national debt. That's not the cumulative personal debt of the American people. I don't think that covers health care or Social Security, the debt from that, how much we need to pay people once they do retire.
Right.
So when you combine all that, the debt's, I think, closer to $100 trillion, if I believe, or something crazy like that when you combine all the numbers.
Yeah, something like $9,000 a person or something like it. Might be even more than that. But you think of all the people who aren't in debt, and then you have to combine all those people with the ones who are in extreme debt, and it kind of meets in the middle at 9,000.
Yeah, and that's where I think it gets to the point of it's such a big number that it's easy to just say, well, just keep the party going, because what are we going to do about it anyway? And just kind of kick it down the road, which we see happen a lot, because it does feel insurmountable, like, wow, we could never pay that back. So, well, just keep on keeping on. And, for a while, maybe we can do that, but eventually it comes to an end. Particularly when if we get squeezed out of the international trade in a lot of ways. So the Trumpet Daily Radio Show talks about that today. There's some good headlines at thetrumpet.com about that as well. The coming China-Germany trade juggernaut, that's by Christopher Eames from March the 9th. And Trade Wars Have Begun by Brad McDonald, March the 2nd. Trumpet.com, check those out as well. Really good articles about what's happening there with the trade, and something you hear about on the news, but not as much as you would at thetrumpet.com, I don't think.
Yeah, it's definitely a prospect, a trade wars, but I think most of the media believe that we live in this utopia where China and all these countries eventually will all get to an agreement and everything will go on for 100 years in stability, and that's not how it's going to go.
No, and I think part of it probably is the fact that people aren't talking about it a lot is, one, maybe just don't know or don't believe it. But number two is it's a very dreadful thought, and it's a fearful thought, because when you get squeezed out of trade, the finances drop, and we have such a high standard of living in this country. I don't think anyone is prepared in any way for that to be rocked in a serious way.
Yeah, actually, right before I came over here, I read a quote about Churchill. When in the early 1900s, he saw some German battle formations, and he was impressed and kind of scared of the German army, but he wrote to his wife saying that, well, I think in the next 50 years, we'll have an unparalleled time of peace and prosperity in the world. And that was in 1906.
Yeah.
So within those 50 years, you had the two worst world wars in all of history and all these things. So from someone like a Churchill politician at that time, no one can really know when tragedy will strike. It can come unexpectedly, even when the best informed people don't see it coming. So to me, that was just a really good example of, that could very well happen in our circumstances today.
Yeah, and I think people in general just don't conceive that that would happen at all. It's just a horrible thought that there would be.
I also think people are just afraid of, or they don't like to think about the fact that people hate us. They don't, and that might be a reason why we've kind of gotten away from teaching history as well. They don't want to think about the ways that we've intervened in different regions of the world that maybe they didn't like, but they probably were for the best of those people. But still, those people, a lot of people in the Far East, the Middle East, do not like America, and that's just reality. We're not just going to somehow magically flip a switch and then get along with everyone.
Well, and there's such a focus on social issues today in the U.S. and political, wranglings, that these bigger issues that affect all of us, like economy, trade, what we're doing with our military, no one can even muster up enough energy to focus on any of those things, those real-world issues.
Yeah, in the meantime, we have these sharks circling around us, and we're too busy fighting each other on the boat to even notice the sharks right in the water.
That's a great analogy.
Thank you. I probably heard it somewhere else. I can't really take credit for it.
That was great. Yeah, put that in the memory bank.
Exactly. At least we just need a plank somehow. Get a plank analogy in there too.
Throw some off the plank. Make them walk the plank.
Yeah,
maybe that'll be a that'd be a great cover for the Trumpet Magazine. Pass that on.
Yeah, maybe we'll
put that on there. You guys interested in this lifetime and going to space? Would you do it if you could for just a day or two?
If it was free.
Okay. It's not, by the way, but yeah.
If there were zero chance of anything wrong happening. Okay. So no. So,
yeah, right. Well, it's interesting because some people are starting to do that. If you've got a lot of money, this is from Bloomberg. Travel tips from a real space tourist. Get ready to feel awful. That's what he says. Just a newsflash. We're not meant to be in space yet. Not long term. Our physical bodies just don't handle it very well. They say if all goes according to plan, Elon Musk's Space Exploration Technologies Corporation will send two paying civilians around the moon and back sometime next year. There's two of you. If you want to go to the moon, around the moon.
He didn't say paying civilians.
Paying civilians. Yeah,
oh, paying civilians.
Phrase.
That's
right.
That's
not happening.
He said, well, maybe you raise some money and GoFundMe. GoFundMe to the moon.
It's the only way.
It's like, go fly me to the moon, but GoFundMe to the moon. My advice to them would be to medicate early and often, says Richard Garrett D. Kayux. I didn't get his name right. He's a video game developer and entrepreneur. He paid $30 million to Russia's space adventures to spend 12 days aboard the International Space Station. Would you trust your life to Russia's space adventures? This guy did.
Probably not.
He made it. But his moon voyaging counterparts have put down a significant deposit, according to a post last week. So people are putting money down that have a lot. It's the ultimate trip. You can tell your buddies, I went around the moon, I went to space. But when you get up there, you have to deal with the fact there's no gravity and they don't feel well when they're up there.
Yeah, there's been lots of studies in the last couple months I've read where they've been analyzing career astronauts when they go to space and the health effects when they retire and they're just living. Some of them can have pretty significant health kickbacks from space travel, radiation. When you're going into space, extreme G-force, your bones become brittle. Everything functions a little differently because you're not in the environment we were meant to live in. So I think it'd be an amazing experience, life-changing experience to be in space. But I think the physical repercussions can be pretty bad.
Yeah. The microgravity that permits the joyous free feeling, that's what the gentleman who went to space said, motion we associate with astronauts also takes serious physiological tolls. Body fluids stop flowing normally, which is why in space people's faces look puffy, and they generally have somewhat bloodshot eyes. It feels sort of like lying on a children's slide head down. That's what the guy said. So if you can picture that, as a kid, that might be fun. As an adult, that does not sound fun to me at all.
No, that's actually a horrible thing to think about.
It is. I think if you want to train for space as an adult, go to the playground. Swing on the swings, lay on the slide. If you can handle that, you'd probably be okay. I can't handle that anymore for some reason. He said, in the first days, you get very stuffed up and have a bit of a headache. Again, this is the guy that was up there for 12 days. So they take aspirin, Sudafed, things like that to try to overcome it. Another side effect comes from the floating fluid in your inner ear. That helps us detect motion and stay balanced. Mm. If people have problems with that, they have, what do they call it, vertigo?
Something like that.
With yeah. It, yeah. In space, of course, it also begins floating. So if you move your head forward, it will slosh to the back and make you feel like you're falling backwards. So there's this odd disagreement between what you see and what's happening. And it really messes with your body, as you can imagine.
That'd be horrible. So you're moving your head forward. You feel like you're actually falling backward.
Yeah.
It's exactly the opposite of what's going on. So no matter what you do, you feel kind of the opposite there.
Right. So they get seasickness, you know, and that perceptual disconnect tends to last for about 3 days before your brain begins compensating. When you get back to Earth, you got another 3 days to readjust.
Oh.
So it's, you know, how was space? Talk to me in 3 days, right? Because you're not going to be feeling well. Other physical challenges, Abraham, you mentioned, they're a little more difficult for them to address. Muscle and bone atrophy. Space travel requires exposure to increased levels of radiation, which can lead to surprising visual effects. The gentleman that was up in space says, all of a sudden you will see this really intense bright white, and then it will fade back out. That is basically you being damaged by radiation. It triggers the impression of light, even though there is no light. So you're being, it's like, yeah, you're just being radiated. No big deal. How much do you want to pay to be radiated in space?
Yeah, that's pretty terrifying. I think that's the big fear we have. I mean, if you're safe in the spacecraft, that's one thing. But when you nothing you can do from being, you think you're being poisoned or having these. I mean, because Earth has a protective shield, many protective shields to protect us from radiation. So when you throw your body beyond those shields, you experience a lot of particles, a lot of different things that your body normally doesn't come in contact with.
You know what they should do? Why don't they just do this with, say, a top scientist, you know, who's a real big proponent of evolution? Just say, well, we're going to drop you off on the moon. You'll evolve, right? You'll develop the ability to live out in space. Apparently, that's what happens. Well, according to the theory.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the big question, too, is there life out there? Well, that life couldn't be anything like us, or else, obviously, we would not be suffering so much anytime we go up in space. We would not be feeling the way we do. And that's with, I presume, helmets on inside the spaceship still.
Right.
Not even going out.
Right.
That's much less taking off the helmet. Then you'd be dead in an instant.
Yeah. It wouldn't be great. So, but it is always funny how there is the thought about evolution, of course. But then, when you want to put it to practice, I don't think you'd have a lot of people signing up for it. I'm sure they'd have their reasons as to why you know, scientifically it wouldn't work or whatever. But that's the point. It doesn't work.
Yeah, it does remind me. I got kind of just a story about how amazing the human brain is. That despite all these challenges a person has in space, it can still do an amazing thing. When Neil Armstrong, not on the moon mission, but on a mission before that, they were testing different docking techniques in his little capsule. It was him and a co-pilot. There was a malfunction on one of the thrusters. A thruster ejects a little bit of fuel and it moves it back and forth. And the thruster was just always on. So it started spinning like a washing machine.
Oof.
And it started going so fast, it was rotating once per second.
Wow.
And so Neil Armstrong, he's the pilot. He's inside. Imagine spinning in a little capsule like a washing machine. A little window. That's all you can see outside. And it's going around. They're about to pass out. And he was able to push buttons and use the joysticks and everything and actually write the spacecraft when it was rotating that fast. Like, to me, that's amazing that he had the presence of mind in space when they're moving that fast. Just a tiny window as orientation, he was able to do all that.
Yeah.
Like, despite how horrible they feel at the time, too.
They should include that as part of the ride.
Yeah.
Going up to space. The Neil Armstrong experience. Yeah. You don't feel good when you go up there, but some people are willing to take a chance on it because it is an adventure. And some people love adventures. You know, if you do mountain climbing or anything like that, there are huge risks. The payoff is, I guess, saying you did it. And that's kind of it.
Yeah. There is an alternative, I think, that is much safer. Some people, they go on the high altitude planes and then go to the very limits of the atmosphere. And so you're so high, you're basically in space, but not quite. You're still in but you can see the curvature of the Earth, and you can see, it feels like you're on top of the Earth, and you can look around and see everything. So you need oxygen and that kind of thing, but you're in a plane, and you can kind of get the same experience, but in a safer, much less expensive experience. And some of the people who have done it say everyone on Earth should do it.
Yeah.
Because then you realize how small we are, each human is, but then how small the Earth is, and that we need to preserve everything because that's all we have. So I think that's the good experience of space. It's almost a spiritual experience where you figure out how precious life is, but it just comes at some cost.
Yeah, it definitely gives you a different perspective, that's for sure. So pretty interesting. If you've ever felt like you just can't figure out what to do with your life, here's a couple of tips from a former Google career coach. And there might be some value in this. 4 secrets for figuring out what to do with your life. You're stuck. You feel like you're in a rut. The lady says, one of the things you should do is draw a mind map. You guys have heard of those, I guess. Mind map is a visual diagram of your interests and goals, and drawing one can help you recognize what's important to you. And so, I don't know. Those things, I don't know. They never really appeal to me because I always feel like just like thinking about what I like to do, because I feel like I'm tricking myself. I'm like, is this really how I feel, or is this how I think I should feel?
Right.
I struggle with that.
You're being an idealist. You're trying to put the priorities in the right place. Even if that's not necessarily how you feel.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel. I'm gonna have to get more in touch with my feelings.
You know how you're supposed to feel.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And or sometimes I think, well, I might feel that way, but should I feel that way? Mm. You know what I mean? But anyway, I guess not a bad idea to write down what you're interested in, of course. They think mind mapping is a good way to brainstorm. Some people really like mind mapping. You guys ever try it? You ever do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once in a while. I just prefer linear notes. Maybe mm-hmm. it's just a habit I have. But my wife does mind mapping for a lot of things. For her, because she's more visual, maybe. She mm-hmm. can remember tons of stuff. I can't just by using her mind map.
Oh, that's interesting. There's a whole process to that as well. And then number two, they say if you're kind of struggling with what to do with yourself, think of personal or work projects you could start. They say if you're lacking a sense of excitement or challenge at work or in your personal life, you should create it. Get a hobby, I guess. Find something you want to do and go after it.
Put some obstacles in your own path.
Yeah. And you see people sometimes they do that. You know, they start training for something just to have something to do. We all need a purpose of some kind, something to work on. And so that's not a bad idea. Number three, they say focus on the skills you'd like to have. Like to be a professional basketball player. Realistic goals or skills. But they say the days of landing a great job simply by rising through the ranks of a company are not as frequent as it used to be, according to some career coaches. They say you have to develop more skills. So developing more skills, that can be fun too, whether it's for a job or just a hobby. It's a good accomplishment when you feel like you're learning something, you're moving forward.
Yeah, well, I think education should be lifelong. Like, I think I know Herbert Armstrong said that. I think a lot of people say that. And if you're always learning, your horizons are always expanding and your mind is always in use. And I think that's one of the keys to having happiness or finding a purpose is always using your mind. Because when your mind gets stagnant or you're in activities where you don't use it, I think that's when you start to feel unfulfilled.
Last point here, if you're feeling a little stuck and you want to progress and move forward, don't stay stuck because of fear, they say. Former Google life coach. That's the big one. Because sometimes you want to do something, but you're afraid. Sometimes that's a good fear. Sometimes it's not. It depends. But, you know, there are probably a lot of people that are that way. I'm sure we all are, where you know, you kind of want to try something, but you're afraid that it might not work out.
Yeah, well, fear does save lives sometimes, but also I think it does hold a lot of people back from reaching their potential. So it's probably important to be discerning about that point and not just get rid of all fear.
Right.
Fear can preserve as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Fear can be a good thing, but it can get in your way too.
Well, I think for me, just thinking about even the last 2 weeks, thinking about things I've been afraid of, I think fearful of your own life is good fear to have, that you should want to preserve it. But I think the fears that hold us back are the fear of failure and the fear of being embarrassed or being made look like a fool because you couldn't do something or that kind of thing. So I think just fear of our vanity being crushed or of failing at something, I think those are the two things that hold us back. Instead of, there is risk involved with success usually.
Yeah. I was reading a write-up by this guy. He coaches a lot of baseball. He had some really good insights, and he was talking about his players, and he said, you know, speaking of like the fear of making a mistake, he said when he coaches players, he never worries if they make a mistake, because that's how you learn. But the key is, do they know why it happened and how to fix it? If they don't know that, that's where he says there's going to be a problem. But if they understand why it happened and they set about to fix it, that's just the learning process, and he's always happy with that.
Yeah, that seems like a good time to have a little bit of fear. Baseball always was motivated by a little bit of fear for me, not wanting to go back to the dugout having made a mistake and be ignored by all my teammates. So sometimes you want to have some fear so that you achieve what you should, and then beyond that even. But at the same time, if you're too afraid, then you won't make any plays.
Yeah. So four tips for maybe helping you if you feel like you're stuck a little bit. And I think there's some good advice in there. Depends on each person, I suppose. Draw a mind map. Think about what you like to do. Think of personal or work projects you could start. Focus on the skills you'd like to have, and don't stay stuck because of fear. So those are some interesting points, and I think some value in them. You guys like to shop at Target? We're not sponsored by Target, by the way.
Yes, actually, I usually do, unless I'm saving money, I guess.
I like Target. Yeah, Target's fine. They say your Target store is about to look a lot different. here's what to expect. On Monday, Target gave shoppers a peek at what a $7 billion investment into the business could mean for their local stores. Coming to Houston area, first of all, in October, Target's first fully redesigned shop will include two separate entrances, one for time-crunched shoppers and another for those who want to browse fashion or beauty. There you go. The speed entrance will lead shoppers to the redesigned grocery aisle, which will include grab-and-go items. It also provides quick access to a wine and beer shop. I don't know about in Oklahoma, but maybe it will. Self-checkout lanes and a counter dedicated to online order pickup. Online order pickup? That's pretty neat. Outside, there will be reserved parking spots for shoppers who want their items delivered to their cars. Can't even get out of your car anymore. Deliver it for me. So that's the first store. They're going to do that in Houston, and then they're going to renovate 600 stores over the next several years. So
wow.
We got a couple of Targets around here. They might be changing somewhat.
Yeah, my sister in Australia, she does online shopping for her groceries because she's a young child, that for her it's just easier.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a lot of people are doing that where they'll order the groceries online and then they'll have them delivered to their house or they'll go pick them up, and it just saves time, especially if you already know what kind of products you want instead of going to the store yourself.
Yeah, we did that when we went to Ireland. Yeah, you could just order. You could order them before you got there, which was nice.
Yeah.
So when you showed up, you had like the food you wanted, and they just deliver them a little box or wagon or something. I forget what it was. And it's a little different. We don't do that in the States as much, but I think other countries do that. And it's just a convenience thing, so it is kind of nice.
Yeah, in Ireland too, though, there's still the small little convenience stores that you probably need a horse wagon to get to.
That's true too. Yeah.
But which are nice, though. They have fresh food and stuff, but it's interesting to have the old and the new there.
New technologies and the old ways. You're listening to Trumpet Radio live here on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com. And you can follow us at Twitter if you'd like to at kpcgfm. Also, email us any comments, questions, concerns, anything to comments at kpcg.fm. Grant, you've got an interesting write-up here. This is from Breitbart. Universities, of course, are very touchy-feely these days about a lot of things. The University of Arizona instructs students to say, ouch, when offended. So, Abraham, anytime during this story, if you're offended by it, you say ouch into the microphone.
Oh, don't worry, I will.
We must respond, oops, whenever.
Is that what happens?
Whenever we acknowledge that we have offended someone, we must say oops.
Okay. This is a thing.
Ouch and then oops.
Okay.
And the person who was hired to make this training manual to hand out to the teachers and hopefully get the teachers to comply with it, made like $214,000.
Wow.
He makes $214,000 a year at the university to basically make a manual that kind of seems like we're talking about kindergarten.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Oops.
Oops.
Yeah, that's the first, I guess, sort of the first thing I thought about was, it seems like little children, like that's kind of, you know, first day of school and you're like, okay, now if you know, say you're sorry or just basic stuff. So, but they're doing this at the university.
Right. And the picture that goes with this is a crying baby. So they're obviously, this article is ridiculing them a little bit, but it is sort of a trend. And this book is titled Diversity and Inclusiveness in the Classroom. It seems to be a cloak for silencing speech, because students can basically say it, ouch, anytime they want to in class, no matter what the teacher's talking about. So, I mean, that just seems like it's going right along with a lot of agendas we've seen.
I could see there being a chorus of ouches and oopses like throughout the day, and it'd be hard to, you know, get much done in class because of the constant ouch and oops. And it feels like you need to clarify too. You know, if you were saying something and someone said ouch, you'd have to say oops, what happened, you know, sorry. But is that what you're supposed to do once you say oops, or is that it, that's the end of it and you just move on?
Well, it would probably be nice to clarify if there were a chorus of ouches going on. just maybe the person saying ouch should say exactly what they were offended by, and then the person saying oops should say exactly why he's saying oops.
Yeah.
It just seems like a big time waster and a way to silence certain types of speech. And this is actually a licensed program, and it has a website that's called ouchthatstereotypehurts.com.
Sadly, that's easy to remember. I was going to say that's going to be a hard one to remember, but I think I'll remember that one.
Yeah.
It's good discovery. It seems like there should be an oops counterpart to the website. Like, you know, oops, I forgot the what the website was. I don't know. So this is a real deal.
And it does remind me of that scripture that says how, you know, if you keep the law, nothing will offend you. Maybe it does get back to some sort of a lawless lifestyle where, you know, anything can offend a person. That's what the scripture implies, is anything could offend somebody who is living completely lawlessly.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the thinking that a lot of people would have been raised with as kids, at least in days gone by, that something may offend you, but you'd have to kind of stop and evaluate yourself first and say, well, is that worth being upset about, or am I just, you know, is it my problem? I think that would be probably the thing that a lot of people would think first, instead of just assuming it's everybody else's problem. It might be your problem.
Yeah, there's definitely a balance. You don't want to offend anybody, but you also don't want to be offended by everything. I mean, people who do either of those things are almost unbearable to be around. If you offend someone with a sharp tongue at pretty much every word you speak, that's not pleasant. But if you're getting upset by nothing, then that's also really tough.
Yeah, this doesn't seem like it would bring any sort of understanding about, because again, if you're just looking to yell ouch every time you're offended, and then the person says oops, are they really sorry? Do they really even understand why you know, it doesn't seem like this would clear the air in any way. It would just fester more disagreement and resentment, and what happens if one says ouch and the other person doesn't say oops?
Oh boy!
Now we've got another ouch.
Now we have a mass
and
triggering.
You owe me two oopses, right? I mean, it just keeps going, and it's just so funny that this is even a thing. But this is an actual deal at the University of Arizona.
Yeah, and that is a pretty superficial program. But if you think about the people giving those classes, we're talking about college professors, people who usually, if you go with the stereotype, sorry to do that, but if you go with the stereotype of a college professor, they have a high-minded way of saying things. They're usually quite dignified by the way they present their class. They're not just shooting off at the mouth and offending people left and right. So these students are being taught to be offended by what a college professor says, not some person who is actually looking to upset you.
Are they saying that, is it focused more on what the professors are saying, or is this kind of just in general, like if they're talking to their peers, the other students, or is it kind of everybody?
It can apply to everyone, but they did hand out this handbook to the teachers, okay. And we're hoping that the teachers would then enact it in their classes, although I'm sure on campus they would hope everyone would do the same thing.
Yeah, I don't know what they would do. My guess would be no one's going to do this. It just seems like it's kind of silliness, and I could see the students kind of making a light of it. I doubt they'll take it too seriously. I don't know. I mean, maybe they would, but it just seems like it seems like most people aren't all that interested in some of this. I don't know what you call it. Really, the social issues. I think people are just trying to get about their day and their business. That's the way it was when I was in college. There were always some that were more into certain things, but most people just minded their own business, went to work, went to school, went home, just didn't really get into anything. I would think that would be the majority of people.
Yeah, that would be the majority, but that would not be the loudest part segment of the college. So a tiny minority could actually force everyone else to comply, or like we were talking about yesterday, maybe there could be the threat of violence if people did not follow through on these types of policies.
Yeah, really interesting times. Really surprising, but that it's funny. You could find a similar story almost every single day. They're just out there. Some of these different policies that they're trying to enact in some schools.
And it's hard to relate to, isn't it? I mean, obviously, whenever you're just walking the street in public, you don't see people who you would think would be doing these types of things. But apparently, on college campuses, it's so commonplace now. Those are like bubbles. The entire campuses are now considered safe spaces. They're really just trying to make sure they avoid offending anybody at all times. That's not really how the rest of society views things in general.
Right, which is a good point, because once you leave and you go get a job, I don't think most companies have this policy. You kind of just have to get along. I don't think you could come in and say ouch too many times at work before people are a little bit upset, maybe.
Or the boss says, oops, you're fired.
Oops, I did
exactly.
It again.
Yeah.
Britney Spears reference there, I think. Somebody from back in the day. But so that's interesting right up there. Breitbart, University of Arizona instructs students to say ouch when offended. So that's surprising, but that is the some colleges today and certain segments of them. And it's amazing, too, when you think about the costs of just a lot of different universities. I mean, it's a major, major expenditure to go there. And you hope to get out of there with the best possible education and really prepared for the next stage of life. And it seems like it's just kind of silliness.
It's something to consider now if people are approaching that college age. Is it even worth it anymore when you know you're going to have a student loan debt of north of $100,000 and you're going to be taught all of these classes where you have to be hypersensitive or basically taught to be sensitive in class? It doesn't really seem worth it.
Yeah. Interesting write up there. Thanks for the look into what's happening at some of these universities, Grant.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio live here on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. One of the things that's going on that's really, really pretty big deal, and it comes in and out of the news occasionally, but it's really important, is bees are being, there's less of them.
Yes.
This is a quick write-up. Abraham got a whole story on this, but this is just a headline that ties in. FoxNews.com, first endangered bee in the United States named. The rusty-patched bumblebee is the first native bee to become an endangered species in the United States. Eric Lee Mader, the pollinator program co-director at the Xerxes Society for Invertebrate Conservation, said the dwindling bee population could have a major impact on the fruits and vegetables produced for Americans to eat. He also feels without the rusty-patched bumblebee pollinating the various crops, the financial impact could be devastating. He said native pollinators in the U.S. provide essential pollination services to agriculture, which are valued at more than $9 billion annually. I know for myself, I don't see bees around like I used to. When I was a kid, I saw them everywhere. I don't now when I see it, it's like an event. Hey, there's right. a bee. So there's less and less of these.
Yeah, there's more. I see wasps and hornets all the time, but I don't see any bees, especially in the South United States.
There is nothing, to me, there's nothing better, I guess, than you see this really fat bumblebee
right.
get on a flower and the whole flower bends over. Because of his weight. And he's just kind of flying around. Looks like a tanker in the air.
Yeah.
Love those guys. You just don't see a lot of them anymore.
Yeah. This is kind of a hidden crisis in a way, because it's something maybe people don't really expect, that our livelihoods depend so much on insects. But with bees, they're a key to stabilizing terrestrial ecosystems. So any ecosystem on the land. The basis of any ecosystem on Earth is plants. Plants provide oxygen. They take in carbon dioxide, give oxygen. They feed the animals that we eat. They feed most of the herbivores that any animal eats, and what humans eat as well. And they provide food for others. They provide fruits and vegetables, all these things. And a plant's life, most plants' lives depend on pollinators. Someone who takes the pollen from flower to flower and so they can reproduce. And bees are probably the most important pollinator, especially in America. And so with these bees dwindling, it's threatening not only food production, not only certain companies who rely on that, but also just our ecosystems in general. It can really hurt them and start to create environments where it's just not that nice to live anymore.
The write-up you have in particular, the Christian Science Monitor one here, the Cheerios company's involved because that's their logo, right? It's the bee.
Yeah.
And so these corporations are realizing what's happening to some extent and trying to get in and help. Where are the bees going? Is it pollution? Is it, what's happening to them?
From what this article says, there's a few different reasons. Not all bees are disappearing, just certain species of them. There are over 3,000 species of bees in the U.S. alone. This is what Dr. Evans, he's a Elaine Evans. She's a scientist who at the University of Minnesota that specializes in bees. And she said that some of the big factors with this declining population in certain areas in the U.S., loss of habitat, disease, pest problems, pesticides, and even warmer or colder weather, extreme weather can kill them off too for a period of time. So when if they take away their habitat, if they're building a city or a highway and you wipe out all the flowers and everything they were using, then they're going to have to relocate or they'll die off. Or I think the big problem is with all the chemicals we put into the environment, the bees die from that. And so we're having widespread deaths usually from chemicals.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was wondering, because we're in a very polluted land in a lot of ways, the whole world is. And I mean, even just locally, I don't know, you know, all the things people put on, say, lawns, but I know, like in my neighborhood, some people will put stuff on their lawns, other people will not, for whatever reason. And, but, you know, there are no, it kills everything except the grass, which looks nicer, I guess. And maybe that's a good thing, but there aren't like the natural flowers that come up. Yeah. And so you just don't see a whole lot of bees. But I see, because I have noticed, for example, like you'll see one lawn that's sprayed with something, and I don't know what it is. And there's nothing there as far as the animals. And if there's a lawn a little ways down that isn't sprayed and it has some more of the natural stuff, you got all the squirrels, birds. The living things are there, and I notice it, and I'm not an expert in any of it, but I just think, you know, I don't want to be over in that lawn. I can smell it, and I don't want to be there. And I think it's the same with them. I imagine the bees would be similar.
Yeah, well, I think most pesticides will kill a human if you eat it, and that's true for animals too and plants. That any living thing, if you come in contact with something like that, it's not good for it. It'll make it sick or kill it off. And I think some of that is it's kind of interesting that the idea of a perfect lawn is just like that perfect thick layer of grass.
Yeah.
If people want it, it looks nice, but is that really what the environment's supposed to be like? Is grass supposed to be the dominant base of an ecosystem? It's not. There's so many other things that different places need to thrive and survive. And so when you, in a suburban situation, when you have a lot of yards like that, it does kill off the bees. And so it is harder to even grow flower plants because the bees aren't there to pollinate them and get them healthy. So I think it's our whole lifestyle in the United States of in our own lawn care, but also just even in the big farming industry where we throw pesticides on everything. Well, it doesn't just stay there. The water takes it, the wind takes it, and it's affecting these bees that really are a cornerstone of how our society works.
Yeah.
And so what General Mills is, it's because Cheerio has like the bee.
Right.
They took the bee off the cereal box, so you're not going to see him around for a while. I guess until the bees are back, then he'll be back too. But they're handing out little packets of flowers. Yeah, flower seeds, so you can plant them, and those flowers will help foster bee populations. So they're starting to do that, and just bring awareness to it so that basically people can start thinking that they need to start fostering bee populations, or we could all really get harmed by it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Like I said, I don't see them around very often. Like you said, I see a lot of wasps and things that are pretty nasty, but I don't see too many bees, but when I was a kid, I remember, this is up in Wisconsin, I have a vivid memory of walking through the backyard, which was, we had some acreage and stuff, and there was lots of flower, all kinds of natural stuff. And I remember just seeing, it was like a field of bees. They were everywhere.
Right.
You could hear them, and they were everywhere. Like, I probably couldn't take a step without there being a couple of bees in the area, little honeybees, you know, not necessarily huge or anything, but all kinds of bees everywhere. And you just don't see that anymore. At least I haven't seen that in years.
Yeah, well, especially maybe the Oklahoma wind plays with them too here in local areas.
Yeah, I mean, there is a difference in regions as well. But I mean, even up there, I mean, they weren't as common.
Yeah, I mean, in Canada growing up, I remember seeing bees always fly past our window, and we'd always look because, especially the really big ones, it looks like they're on a stick or something like that because they're so big, but they're just a bumblebee. But actually, we had a cat. We let him out in the yard so they can run around and stuff. He would catch bumblebees in his mouth. He wouldn't kill them. He just put them in his mouth. He'd carry them to us, put them down. and then they fly off.
Wow.
So he was pretty courageous, but or lack of intelligence.
They sting him?
No.
Really?
Yeah, just a odd habit he got into.
Well, what a weird feeling that would be if it was buzzing around in your mouth like that.
Yeah. Yeah, he just had his mouth clamped on it just enough where it couldn't move or sting him or anything, but I didn't hurt it either.
So. What a weird thing for a bee.
Yeah.
You're like, what was that?
Yeah.
All right, well, back to the flowers.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I've never heard that before.
Yeah. But yeah, in Canada, I mean, it's not the best climate for them. In Saskatchewan, where I live, it's basically open fields, so there's lots of them up there. But yeah, it's I think as cities get bigger, there's more industry and that kind of thing. It really does hurt their population. And now they're very... they're very good at bouncing back and very hardy too, so that they are sticking around. But we do need to, I think, be a little more careful on how we manage them and make sure we're thinking long term, because this could create a huge crisis in American food production.
Yeah, we need those. We need those bees, because it is a major deal. And as that Fox article pointed out, more than $9 billion annually in the economy that could be affected if there's a bee problem. So, pretty interesting. So, anytime you see a bee, don't kill them. Let them go.
Yeah.
Let them fly free. They're always bees are nice bees. They never usually look for trouble anyway, unless you really mess with them. So that's pretty interesting. That's good to keep an eye on. That the bee population is important. You've got one other story for us today, a historical one. Martin McGuinness. I believe he was a leader of the IRA. He died today. That was on our headlines here on KPCG. And so you've got some of the history of the struggles between Ireland and England that have gone on over the years. I think anybody that's been alive in the 80s and aware of what was going on, you'd hear about the IRA on the news and you'd hear about bombings and things like that. And so what's the history here of Martin McGuinness?
Yeah, he's a pretty controversial figure, as in anyone from that time period. And this is, I think, really good history to go over, because it does show when two groups can't solve anything politically, it can erupt into just terrible violence that was between Ireland, Northern Ireland, and the UK for a good 30 years. Now, going back there for centuries, there have been Protestant Catholic wars in Ireland, wars between the Irish and British for independence. So those are kind of always underlying the background, those sentiments and the hard feelings of atrocities and that sort of thing on both sides. But the modern struggle here that Martin McGuinness was a part of, it's called the Troubles, is the name. It's also called the Northern Ireland Conflict. And basically, it lasted from the late 1960s to 1998. Martin McGuinness was a part of the Good Friday Belfast Agreement in 1998. He became, I think, the first deputy prime minister or leader of the Republic of Ireland after that. But just to briefly go over this, I think it's just good to go over, because I think we remember all these names, but what do they actually mean? Basically, the main cause of the feud was that the Republic of Ireland, Southern Ireland, was mainly Catholic. They were their own country, but there were six counties in Northern Ireland that stayed, they were mainly Protestant, and they stayed with the United Kingdom. And that's what's known as Ulster, or Northern Ireland. So they're still part of the UK. But the Republic of Ireland is a separate political entity. And basically, the Republic of Ireland wanted those six counties to be a part of Ireland. They want one nation, while those Northern Ireland peoples, most of them Protestant, were fearful of being in a democracy where there's such a small minority. They wouldn't get any rights. They would be oppressed. And so they stayed with the UK. And so there were always feuds, family feuds, political feuds. And eventually both sides began building paramilitary groups, or basically volunteers who would start fighting guerrilla-style tactics, even terrorism. And during the late 60s, this erupted again. In the 20th century, there have been wars and civil wars between inside of Ireland, 1916, 1920s. But in the late 1960s, you started having Ulstermen started killing off certain Catholics, revenge killings, intimidation, even terrorism with car bombs, that kind of thing. And then you had the IRA, which is the Irish Republican Army, and other groups start to kill Protestants in Northern Ireland as revenge, trying to intimidate them so that they can then get all of Ireland unified. And so this went on for a while, and the most violent times were in the 70s, where you had up to 500 people die in 1 year. I think that was 1972. It's the bloodiest year of the conflict. Most of them were civilians, just people minding their everyday lives. Petrol bombs would go off. They'd be dragged from their cars and shot in a ditch on the side of the road. Just lots of this terrible things happening in this modern European state. It's just a very brutal civil war. And it wasn't an honorable war. It was both sides would murder people. They would set up checkpoints, and if they were having a bad day, they might just kill you. And it was all just to try to send a message to the UK to try to figure out what was going on. The UK sent in the British Army, and they were pretty heavy-handed, making sure order was restored in Ulster. And then the UK also sent in the SAS and the infamous Black and Tans that were former Special Forces soldiers who came into Northern Ireland, and they would work behind the scenes trying to figure out who the IRA was and then either kill them or get intelligence on them. And so just a lot of back alley fights, murders, that kind of thing. And sometimes it was really catastrophic where car bombs would go off in the middle of a busy pub time before like a horse race or something, and dozens of people would die. Sometimes pregnant women would be caught in the crossfire. So Martin McGuinness, he was part of the Sinn Féin, who is the political arm of the IRA. They're the political side of it. They started to negotiate with the UK for a peace treaty, and this came about in 1998 after they think 500,000 people were injured or affected by this conflict, and about 4,000 to 6,000 people dead.
Yeah, it's amazing how it's not that long ago, you know, and it's one of those things that was an ongoing issue there. You know, it's not on the scope of a major war as we would consider it, but yet for those people, very, very serious. And you probably noticed this too, because I know you've been to Ireland also. You see some signs and things that point back to some of that history. Walking around, I remember in Dublin seeing some things that pointed to different political situations like that. And it's a little bit different. We don't have a lot of that in the U.S. where people have some sort of the only thing you see is an old bumper sticker, right? Where somebody supported, you know, Al Gore or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, pointing back to like these bitter conflicts that they had. So that's still very much in the fabric of their lives, because, I mean, they probably all know, a lot of them probably know people that were affected directly, or maybe themselves, they were affected directly, because it's not a large country and you've got that kind of violence between people that they're, you know, brothers. It's a brutal thing.
Yeah, it's actually, when I was in Ireland, I caught a cab to go to my hotel, and I was talking with the cab driver, and his grandfather was in the IRA and was involved in that. But he just told me politely that, well, people don't like foreigners coming in and probing them about that kind of stuff.
Oh, really?
Because it's illegal. It's if you're part of the IRA, you can be charged for terrorism.
Oh, okay.
Or because they were terrorists. I mean, during the 80s, the IRA was funded by Gaddafi in Libya, because Thatcher was prime minister and Gaddafi wanted to get back at Thatcher. So he funded the IRA, gave them arms, ammunition, bombs, money. And so there's a lot of illegal activity, a lot of espionage, that kind of thing. So it's something that's not spoken of. But as you mentioned, it's part of their national identity. It's part of who they are, and it's something they hold on dear to. I think a lot, maybe not the newer generation who grew up after, like the millennials, but for all those older people, just bitter conflict. People will never forgive each side for losing loved ones, losing their fathers, innocent people just caught in the battle. So,
well, that's really, it's really interesting to know that, because if you go there on a trip, you know, you don't know. You could ask somebody something. It's good to know that you shouldn't.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was very polite to me about because and I was just interested because I read a lot about the history of it. But yeah, you just have to be careful what you say, even in an Irish pub. I think the famous drink, the black and tan, is like Guinness and a different beer mixed together.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
The black and tans in Ireland were the basically ex-convicts and soldiers who beat up a lot of the Irish people. They're very brutal people. So if you order a black and tan, they'll ignore you.
Oh, really?
Or they'll kick you out of the pub.
Wow.
They have a different name for the same drink over there. But yeah, you cannot say black and tan in Ireland because to them it's an insult because they were their mortal enemies.
Yeah.
So that's something, that's one of those taboo words you can't say over there, including Oliver Cromwell and different things like that.
Wow, it's really interesting. A lot more even to talk about there, but we're out of time for today. But that's a really interesting history, and it's history that's just, boy, it's not that long ago. And some travel tips, too.
Yeah.
Actually, some good ones. So that's all the time we have for on today's episode of Trumpet Radio Live. For myself, Dwight Fault, Grant Urge, and Abraham Blondeau, enjoy the rest of your Tuesday, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.